Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining are digital strategist Winter Mitchell.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello.
Academic and DJ Oliver Wang.
Hi, Guy.
Hello, Oliver. Since Margaret Wampler is away for the holidays, welcome back, academic, karaoke star, and fifth Beatle of Pop Rocket, Karen Tongson.
Season's greetings.
Season's greetings. Every week, we start the show by taking a question from a listener about our own pop culture taste. This week, I want you guys to tell me, what is your favorite on or off-Broadway musical adaptation to film? I know that I should be going for something out there in indie, and, you know, what you want is to hear somebody talk about Hedwig. But for me, like, I'm all about West Side Story. I'm all about, like, you know, getting Rita Moreno and George Chakiris. And I feel like in a period of time, like in the 60s, when they were screwing up a lot of the adaptations, when they were dropping Julie Andrews from My Fair Lady and stuff like that, that we got Rita Moreno giving us America on screen in 1960 makes me so happy. Actually, no. As I'm even saying this, I'm realizing there is only one answer and I'm completely wrong. The answer is Flower Drum Song. Whoa. I know that I'm not supposed to love Flower Drum Song, but like being a child and seeing something. Talk to me, Oliver.
No, I desperately need you to unpack this because I want to hear what you have to say.
Okay. It was the most San Francisco thing I had ever seen, ever. It is so full of good songs, and also just seeing a movie where Asian Americans or Asians weren't side characters, they weren't bad guys from World War II, they were people who were representing like a flurry of different experiences, and Nancy Kwan is so fucking amazing. Like, I understand that people have problems with songs like I Enjoy Being a Girl, but she just is so excited about her own existence. She's just so thrilled by being beautiful. And anytime I walk anyone through Chinatown, I do always sing Grant Avenue. Grant Avenue is a fucking great song. Yeah. And it is like, it is a, for those of you who don't know, it's this Rodgers and Hammerstein musical about Chinatown that is based on a novel by a Chinese American novelist. But they're bringing a lot of white guys in the late 50s, early 60s to the table with their representation of things. But by the end, the nobility of people being like super like observant of traditions and all of that is like seen as noble. And the girl who is Americanized is seen as a little bit slutty. but it still gives you a number of different Chinese American immigrant experiences. And I fucking love it. And I'm sorry I realized that only halfway through answering the
question. Did you ever see the David Henry Hwang adaptation?
I never did.
With Lea Salonga.
And the descriptions felt like it had lost some of the fun. Like, what, did you see it?
I saw it when it was at the Taper, actually.
Yeah.
And I really loved it. I loved its kind of darker elements, but it did have the fun. And Lea Salonga is an incredible performer and singer. And actually, one of the best things that ever happened to me was that I went to the restaurant there at the Music Center afterwards, and they thought I was on the cast. of Flower Drum Song. They gave me a 30% discount. One instance in which racism actually works for
all
you.
Right.
But one of the great things about Broadway is you have this weird process of creating talents. Lea Salonga came out of Miss Saigon, and then they were like, we have this talent. What are we going to do with her? In the same way that, like, Nell Carter, they were like, oh, God, she's so great. What are we going to do? And they wrote Dreamgirls for Nell Carter, and then she got a TV show and she couldn't do Dreamgirls. But there is something really exciting about those stories of, like, Lea Salonga was just too talented not to do anything, so they had to bring back Flower Drum Song, but also figure out how it worked in the 90s.
And she's doing Allegiance now, right?
Yeah, she's doing Allegiance. I just saw Allegiance.
How is it?
I thought it was great. I mean, I think that there are many ways in which it could be better.
This is the musical about...
About Japanese internment, actually.
Yeah. Written by George Takei.
Well, it's based on his life story, actually. And so he stars in it. It's written by somebody else. And I can't believe I'm forgetting his name. But an incredibly talented, mostly Asian-American cast. And it was really profoundly moving to see them on stage performing this material and, you know, really bringing a new Asian-American story to the stage.
Karen, what's your favorite?
You know, I love anything and everything from the kind of golden age of musical adaptation, mm-hmm. 60s. I even liked, you know, Hello, Dolly from 1969. But, I mean, I don't know if I had to choose one. Fiddler on the Roof.
Let's go back to Hello, Dolly just for a moment and say, as Californians, we don't experience Broadway through movies and through cast albums.
And albums, yeah.
And so you can talk all the shit you want about how Barbara Streisand shouldn't have been in Hello, Dolly, but that's how I learned to love Hello, Dolly.
Exactly. That's sort of how I wanted to preface my relationship to these films. Number one, I wasn't alive in the 60s or the 70s, so right. I couldn't see – many of these shows weren't in revival on Broadway even. So it began with the cast albums and then moving on to the films. Sound of Music, of course. I actually think that the way that Robert Wise kind of blew up the scale of Sound of Music and, you know, incorporated all of that alpine lushness. Yeah. And also Julie Andrews. I mean, you know, you can't complain when you go from Mary Martin to Julie Andrews.
Yeah.
I think that the Sound of Music really is like my kind of text entry into, like, you know, loving, appreciating musical theater.
But talk about Fiddler.
But I also think that Fiddler does a similar thing insofar as there are many things that you can accomplish cinematically in a production of Fiddler on the Roof that, you know, all the different stage productions of Fiddler I've seen, from the Center Theater Group to your average middle school or high school. We did it at my high school, for example, right? You know, there's something about the scale that you can bring to this sort of epic, hardscrabble, diasporic drama.
Here's
that's gorgeous.
A Fiddler observation. I had always, like, I had seen the Norman Jewison film, and that was the album that I had listened to, but then I got the original cast album, and there is something to, on the song Matchmaker, there is something to having worse singers, less well-produced, that makes that song better.
Yeah.
When it is a thinner, reedier song, you are more in, oh, these are girls whose lives will be determined by whatever man is handed to them. Like, they're, like, however much these Jews are on the edge of existence, these girls are even more on the edge of existence. And, like, the nicely produced number from the movie never really captured that for me in the same way.
See, but I liked that. I mean, it was also – didn't they make Fiddler, like, in 1970 or 69, 70?
Yes, 69 or 70. Yeah.
So there was also this kind of like hints of psychedelia in 60s.
Yes.
Like, you know, it was kind of – there were ways in which the story in Fiddler about resisting whatever the Tsarist state was doing was very much related to kind of countercultural themes. And so there's some stuff like also with – the Havala ballet sequence, you know, that feels very much like it could be, you know, it's very Summer of Love, right?
Yes.
So that's part of why I'm attached to that cinematic adaptation.
Our last dream ballet. Oliver, what's your answer?
So I didn't really have one, but I'm going to totally rip yours off and give another second nod to Flower Drum Song, partly because, I mean, for one thing, I used to teach an Asian American film and video class at Berkeley back in the late 90s and early 00s, and that would be one of the first films I would show every year, partly because it has historical importance as being kind of the first Asian American feature film. But I also think that in the ways in which we think about these themes around identity and generation gaps as being very contemporary, these were things that were being dealt with or being struggled with at some point in the 1960s as well. So it's not I think it's useful to kind of demonstrate the kind of cyclical nature of a lot of these things as it pertains to sort of different waves of immigration. And the thing with Flower Drum Song is, yes, I think one could be critical of it to say that it's two white guys writing about their own vision of Chinatown, but if you know anything about the history of San Francisco Chinatown, and I want to make a quick shout out to Roman Mars and his podcast 99% Invisible, because they did a really great segment on the history of San Francisco Chinatown, is that whole neighborhood was designed for white tourists. And so it seems actually kind of apropos to have white guys writing about a neighborhood that it itself was meant to market itself to white people. Mm-hmm. So,
and that story is also very much about, like, white people observing Chinese culture and what that's doing to Nancy Kwan's character, I forget, Linda Low. Linda Low versus this, you know, like, fresh immigrant who is still bringing with her, like, real traditions, where Linda Low represents...
Right, the Americanized ABC version. You know, we were talking the other week about the controversy around Audrey Hepburn replacing Julie Andrews in My Fair Lady. Same thing in this case, because the person who sung that part of Linda Lowe on Broadway was Pat Suzuki, who was a very successful recording artist. But for whatever reason, I don't know if it's because they didn't think she was photogenic enough or didn't have enough acting experience, she didn't get to play her own character, even though I'm pretty sure she still does the songs. I think Nancy Quant's lips
support the decision.
It's lip syncing it. I just want to say, though, Pat Suzuki does on one of her later albums, and she recorded for, I think, RCA Victor, but she does a version of Love Look Away, which is from Flower Drum Song on an album, and just it's an amazing, amazing version of it. And I forget which Pat Suzuki album it is, but look for Love Look Away by Pat Suzuki. It's not the cast album. It's just her own album, but she revisits, I think it's a medley of Flower Drum Songs, and it's an amazing version that Renee Tajima uses in this film My America from 1997. I'm getting way too inside Asian American baseball right now, but yes.
All right. Here's the thing.
Yes.
Pat Suzuki is an amazing singer.
Yes.
But having Nancy Quant, who can't fucking sing, and they have to dub every one of her songs, I still stand by.
No, she was great.
Because she's a fucking movie star, it was almost parallel to the situation I was talking about where she had been in the world of Susie Kwan,
right.
and they needed to do something, or the world of Susie something.
Susie Wong.
But they needed to do something with her, and so they put her into this vehicle, and she's one of the reasons it got made. But she just sells every fucking moment and loves performing so much that I actually feel like it is the counterposition to My Fair Lady with Audrey.
Marnie Nixon singing for Audrey. But Marnie Nixon for Natalie Wood worked out.
Yes.
You know.
And the other thing about Flower Drum Song, the movie specifically, is that it managed to provide a vehicle for people who really – Asian Americans working in Hollywood really just trying to get a decent role. So you had James Shigeta, who was like a freaking fox back in the day.
Yeah.
Jack Su, who basically paid his dues from like day one. You know, he gets to play a role. Nancy Quan that you mentioned. So I think in a lot of ways, that's the other thing I like about it is that it provided this a star vehicle for people who ordinarily didn't get star vehicles.
Right. Winner, what's your favorite musical adaptation?
I was going to say Guys and Dolls, but I realized that it's been so long since I've seen it. I couldn't even pull up a reference from it. As brilliantly as you guys have. So growing up, we had much more access to ballet and opera versus musicals. Musicals were sort of like not so easily to obtain, especially for like school purposes or if your parents wanted to buy you tickets. So the only musical I've seen as an adult in the last 10 years has been Rock of Ages. And I actually loved the movie. I know it didn't do anything at the box office.
Really?
I like Tom Cruise. You know how I feel about Tom Cruise.
I wanted to see that, but I never made it.
It's long, way too long. It's about 30 minutes too long. But it is – the show itself, I really liked that they were able to sort of capture just like the way they move on stage and the way they incorporate songs from the 80s. And do these medleys, and then they have like an entire sequence that takes place at Tower Records, which used to be on Sunset.
Yeah,
that was something I always felt like I could connect to that, even though I was brought up looking, you know, seeing Guys and Dolls when I was a kid, and seeing Hair and Cats, but like you know, obviously the revivals that were in San Francisco. I just liked Rock of Ages. I saw it here about 2-3 years ago, and I really enjoyed – that was like a really fun show. Just because you can sing along and you can kind of relate because you were I was an 80s baby.
Well, and the jukebox musicals really help do that. I mean, you know, what it does is provide a different access point for people who want to be able to sing along right away and, you know, you know, and that's –
And immediately
I like
have
that
connection with it.
My friend Chris Schleicher is obsessed with the concept of going and seeing Hamilton and Get on Your Feet and talking about how much Get on Your Feet is a better musical. He has seen neither of them thus far, but he is already committed to the opinion. Thanks to Bryce Lee Wynn for that question. Coming up on this week's show, we're going to talk about the election in pop culture and the ways it's being represented so far. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Winter Mitchell, what are you all about this week?
I'm literally obsessed and probably not getting off this train anytime soon with DJ Khaled's Snapchat. I'm sorry. He's the most motivational, inspirational figure of 2015. I would dare anybody to challenge me on this. He is a producer a rap producer, and he's, you know, featured on different songs, and he's worked with a lot of different people like Rick Ross, and I don't know who else he's worked with. He's made like a bunch of songs that have been number one, and it's the songs they play at the club when they're popping bottles and they're bringing them out to you with like fireworks. But
because you do that all the time.
Because I actually just did it Friday night. It was amazing. But he is also on his Snapchat every morning. His process is pretty much the same. He wakes up. He gets in his elevator. He goes downstairs to breakfast. He eats pretty much the same breakfast every morning, which is egg whites, turkey sausage, and Polar Springs water bottle. Then he gets on his jet ski and goes to people's houses. He gets in jacuzzis. He goes to the club. His Range Rover has...
All of this is being communicated via Snapchat.
All of this is being communicated via Snapchat. And it's in... Now, he's doing all this stuff, and all this stuff sounds ridiculous, right? Like, why would I want to watch this person doing this all day? While he's doing this, he's giving you inspirational messages. So he's on a jet ski telling you they don't want you to jet ski. They don't want you to enjoy your life. They don't want you to have egg whites for breakfast. And the they we've determined are haters and people who are your adversaries. And he waters his plants. He has a huge – he sits there and tells you he gets in his hammock and talks to you about, like, the meaning of life and what you have to do to strategically obtain what you need to get through life and have a beautiful day and to, you know, get negative people out of your life. And I have to tell you, the messages that he has brought forth has somehow penetrated my soul. I was looking for like some type of inspirational figure to make me feel like what I'm doing is not ridiculous, what my goals are not out of range. And I'm like, this guy is not the most attractive. I would never give him a second look. And the only reason we're probably paying attention to him is because he makes pretty good music. But it's fascinating to watch. I tell you, if you watch like a week of it, you'll be completely inspired. It's way more inspiring than a Tony Robbins seminar, I promise you.
All right.
What's the video limit on Snapchat? Like
10 seconds.
Okay, so he's doing all these things in 10 seconds.
It's sometimes like 5 minutes I'm sitting there. I don't care. Mm-hmm. I mean, he does so much in one day. He's on an elevator. He's in his house. He's looking at jewelry, picking out watches. I mean, he's doing all of this. And at the same time, he's not being obnoxious. He's telling you what you need to do. And I'm telling you, it's sweeping the nation.
Ooh. I'm still not on Snapchat. That just says how old I am, right? You know.
Yeah. Acquiring new social media platforms as time goes on gets harder and harder.
But now I want to join because you're telling me about
this. But the thing is, like, between him and, like, the people that are the Snapchat stars, he by far, like, I don't want to – like, I don't know if you've ever – you've never seen one, but, like, Kylie Jenner's Snapchats are, like, 100% unwatchable. It's hard to believe that somebody exists in the world like this, and this is what people find fascinating.
Seeing someone's breakfast is always satisfying.
Yeah. His breakfast is – he has four-course lunches. I love it when he has two lunches in one day. It's like – it's ridiculous.
I can get behind that.
Yeah.
Karen, what are you all about this week?
Okay. So I have two answers, and one is a good queer answer and one is a bad queer answer. My good queer answer is Transparent Season 2. Which I binged all of just last week when I returned from travels.
The show is mostly in Yiddish now.
Yeah, absolutely. It is. And, you know, one of the things – I'm not going to talk about the show in an extended manner. I just wanted to give a shout out to – because we think about so many of the big quality shows these days as, you know – filtered through the showrunner or the star who runs it, your Matt Weiners, your Aaron Sorkins, et cetera. And there has been, rightly so, a lot of attention placed on Jill Soloway. But I think what makes Transparent such a wonderful success and something that also, to me, feels authentic is precisely because of the extent to which the trans and queer communities of Los Angeles, the creative queer communities, are involved at every level of the production, from Zachary Drucker and Reese Ernst at the producing level, Silas Howard, the first trans TV director who directed a couple of episodes this season, Ali Liebegott in the writer's room.
Ali's a very funny comic. You guys should look her up online.
Yeah. And even the accountant, says, oh, trans woman of color, and Christina Davies, who just edited these wonderful featurettes precisely about the community that's involved in the making of Transparent, employing so many queers and trans people in Los Angeles and giving a platform for them in the industry.
It almost makes you a little sad for the people who made The Danish Girl, because they were like cooking up a recipe that's supposed to be prestige and wonder, and you know, only then did the world change to a point where we now realize it is creepy to watch a group of people make art about people who aren't participatory in the process. Mm-hmm. Like, to do it as like the brave vision of heterosexual cis white people talking about others. Mm-hmm. And now those poor Danish Girl people, they'll still do fine at the Oscars. Yeah. But how much the and basically
that's actually a good point. I don't think they're going to do as well this year because of it.
Yeah. But the makers of Transparent got a lot of pushback after the first season with sort of a who are the trans voices who are helping shape this show. And they responded by – and there were always a lot of trans people mm-hmm. on the show. But getting more trans people in the writer's room and working to help people who mm-hmm. hadn't had a lot of opportunities to be like – in the mix for staff writing jobs, be in the Absolutely. Mix for staff writing jobs here, so that, you know, 10 years from now, these trans men and women can just be working on some shitty multicam.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, and one of the things, too, though, I mean, one of the critiques that the show gets is for its rather homogenous, racially homogenous representation of queer scenes in Los Angeles, queer and trans scenes in Los Angeles. And the one thing that I would have to say about that is that I think it's time for us to stop complaining about when representations of the worlds in which we traffic, meaning the actually segregated scenes, mm-hmm. Racially mm-hmm. segregated queer scenes, are failing as representations because they're not doing the work of inserting a more integrated vision of folks. For us, we need to be doing that work ourselves instead of complaining about
it. Well, Transparent has never made efforts at seeming universal. Mm-hmm. Like, it is very much the story of entitled West Side Jews.
Absolutely. And that entitlement is part of the humor and what's yeah. skewered and parodied in the show.
And what's your bad queer answer?
My bad queer answer, and I'm so excited that winter is here. Winter is coming. Is I'm obsessed with the hetero kink disaster porn that is The Affair. And that show is just – it's like I started watching season one when I was traveling and, you know, I was watching it in the airport like on my laptop. But then there were so many nasty sex scenes that like people like over my shoulder, all these people like humping wildly. I had to like minimize the screen.
Yeah.
I love it because season two has opened up – you know, it's a show that's told from the perspective of characters who – the first season with the characters who are engaging in extramarital affairs, and then it opens up to the perspective of their former spouses in season two.
Right.
And the kind of Rashomonic quality of it is really fascinating because you see how, in many respects, affairs, desires, relationships are so much about our own narcissism and what we project onto these scenes of seduction or even argument or what have you. And the cast, particularly my favorite, I would mm-hmm. like sell my soul to, I mean, just hang with Maura Tierney for like a whole day. She's brilliant in The Affair, but the entire cast is really great too.
Well, the thing about the first season is the first season was so romantic. Like, it really – that what is what I liked about the bait and switch between season one and season two.
I thought it kind of creepy. But like,
it was totally creepy whenever you got to his perspective because it was so sexually, like, oversexed. But the fact that they, like, kind of pulled you in with that typical, like, romance novel, like, they're unrequited lovers and they deserve to be together. They're each own – their one true pairing is these two, Allison and Noah together. And then you get to season two and it's just like, this is not a good pair. She does not fall into his lifestyle at all. He's
or his very, fantasy of what she is.
Or his fantasy of what she is. It's suffocating. They're messy. And I like how it went from this is the romantic part where you guys get all obsessed with, the part where everybody gets drawn to be stepping outside of my marriage and getting in with someone that's new pussy. And then you go into season two where it's like, and this is how shit really shakes out when you really gets right down
and
to
it. And it turns out he just wanted a bunch of new pussy and not just one. And it was like, and that's again the kind of truth of it. And the especially in the later episodes of season two, there are all these really kind of wonderful monologues, particularly for the male characters. Mm-hmm. And his session at the shrink.
With Cynthia Nixon.
Yeah, with Cynthia Nixon playing the shrink. And, you know, his session where he, you know, starts exploring his great man theory and how, like, basically to be a great man, a great author, a great artist, you have to run around, like, fucking a bunch of women,
yeah.
Right?
it's let, just me, like, let me take notes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's like, you just want to be a good guy or a great man, you know? And I was like, the narcissism of that was just so fantastic. And Dominic
narcissism
West.
But his narcissism really exploded in season two because he was completely suffocated in season one.
Yeah.
You know, I really sympathized with Noah and Allison because I thought they're both of their spouses are just 100% obnoxious and suffocating them. But left on their own devices, they need people to control them.
I clearly need to be paying attention to the show.
It's so
good.
No, I do
good.
Too.
I feel
it's
the
writing
way.
Is just. Like,
I want to watch this.
I do love Maura Tierney.
And the Fiona Apple theme song is just.
We've
you know,
talked about it so much, but the writing is just. Mm.
This week, I'm all about the film Tangerine. Tangerine is like, it will be described two ways by two different groups of people. Like straight boy film nerds will always describe it as that movie that was made on iPhones. And queer people will always describe it as that movie about two trans girls on Santa Monica Boulevard. It's really good. It is a lovely comedy about a trans sex worker who gets out of jail. She was in jail for possession of crystal meth. Gets out and hears that her man has been messing around with somebody else. And it is her searching to find her man to call him to accounts while her best friend is trying to get people to come to her show at Hamburger Mary's on Christmas Eve.
Yes.
The movie is on Netflix now. It takes place entirely along Santa Monica Boulevard in the world where we live.
How far east do they go?
Like Virgil Village.
I mean, the heart of it is donut time.
Oh, and
yes! Donut time.
From there you go to Hamburger, as far west as Hamburger Mary's. And
rest
how
in
far
peace,
east?
Donut time.
Probably as far east, like near Virgil.
Yeah, like near Virgil. And it is a delightful buddy comedy. And what's so interesting is like, after I watched it, it was so much fun and so lovely and just so, like, real that I immediately went to go read reviews and listen to podcasts and try to get sort of, like, reflections back of other people's thoughts. And the number of people who were sort of like, oh, it was so sad or this should have been a drama or referred to the guys who were attracted to them or in relationships with them as being purportedly heterosexual. Mm-hmm. I was just like, what's wrong with you? Like it's such a fun, upbeat movie, and it is very deeply a Christmas movie. It is very deeply a Christmas movie and a movie about how having other people who care about you is the most important thing. But there are so many tropes that this movie could have fallen into if anyone else was doing it. If this were cis guys in a wig, this would have been a tragedy. If there were cis guys in a wig,
like two Jared Letos.
Yeah. But also, like, there's no way that her pimp would have legit been in love with her. Like, it would have in it, her pimp has been having sex for the past month with a cis woman. And, you know, Hollywood wants to make that a tragedy of, oh, what you'll never have, when the simple fact is he'd rather be with her. Like, he was just getting some while she was gone. It's so much fun. It's so funny. There is a really lovely subplot about an Armenian-American guy who is married and has a family on the east side, but who is, like, deeply transphilic and has never been able to sort of like figure out how to express that or deal with that. And the film does a lovely job of showing the ways that he is also shortchanged by society. But the strength of this movie, that it is a good time, that it is about like girls just trying to run a scheme and get through the day, is so wonderful. And it's just sitting there for you on Netflix, and you should all watch it.
Does it get the city well? Does it understand L.A.?
It's so fundamental. Like, Oliver, I cannot express to you how
much.
That's
what I've heard about it, is that beauty shots of Los Angeles.
Beauty shots. And there's a lot of public transportation, but there is a lot of public transportation by, like, it is an expression of the class of people who cannot afford to be motorists in Los Angeles, which is a thing that is so much forgotten. What's so weird is that it is in a place that is so much represented in other movies, but about the people who are always background in those movies. And it has, A, it is beautiful. Like, I believe that the tangerine in the title is just a reference to the color of sunsets.
Like, the sunset, yeah.
Like, that it is capturing. But it is so beautiful, and the performances are, like, there are two women, Katana Kiki Rodriguez and Maya Taylor. And while watching it, I was like, oh, Maya Taylor is such a good actress for the first, like, 20 minutes. And she is. But Katana Kiki Rodriguez was just giving you so much frenetic energy that she seemed like an annoying trans sex worker. And then you're like, oh, no, this is a performance. You need to, like, respect the fact that she is giving you I'm on crystal methamphetamine, and creates such beautiful arcs of her journeys on, like, wait, is she on meth or crack? Whichever one you smoke. The point is that...
You can smoke both.
I don't know. The point is that, like the arcs of her fixes and the way that affects the pacing of the movie is so wonderful. And, like, it's, you know, it is one of those moments where you encounter your presumption that this person cannot be different than her character, because she is a trans woman from Los Angeles, because the performer is a trans woman from Los Angeles. And how creepy is that? How weird is that? That Jared Leto is brave, but Katana Kiki Rodriguez must not be acting.
Right. Right.
And, like, once I sort of, like, cracked through that in my head, like, I was just so impressed by the authenticity she was giving, but also the sense of fun. And the movie just never, ever dips into the pathos that we have come to expect from queer movies. Oliver, what are you all about this week?
So I'm in the middle of the third season of the Danish/Swedish police drama known as Braun, which is what FX eventually remade into The Bridge. And I realized there was also a British version, which is called The Channel. And the great thing about a series that's based upon, you know, any kind of border between two countries is, think about the various ways that you could remake it. You could make The Gate. You could make, you know, The Checkpoint, whatever. But so this is the original series that all of the subsequent series have been based off of. And it involves a police officer who's working in Copenhagen, and then one who's in Malmö, Sweden. And there's a bridge that connects these two cities. What works about it to me is not so much about the plots of any given season, because they are insanely thorny. You're getting red herringed all the time. Every single new episode introduces two new characters, at least, who somehow fit into the greater puzzle piece. And it gets a little bit convoluted, all the time. Why you watch it is because of the interplay between the main lead, which is – her character's name is – she's the police officer on the Swedish side, Saga Norén, played by Sofia Helin. I hope I'm getting her name right. She's on the spectrum. She's like a functional autistic, but she doesn't read social cues. And that's a big part of how she interacts with her coworkers, with suspects and other people. And somehow for three seasons going, they've managed to squeeze so much of the enjoyment out of the series has been simply watching her interactions with various people as they're trying to solve, like, these horrific, way insane, convoluted serial killer murders. But in a lot of ways, those are really all backdrop to just watching her, like, learn how to navigate her way through the day and talking to people. But not like – she's not played for laughs, even though I think there's a lot of humor that's involved with this. It's also just trying to see everyone in her orbits trying to kind of figure her out along the way.
Better or worse than Borgen?
As a character, better than anyone on Borgen, but I thought Borgen was tighter plot-wise. The first season of Braun is it begins really interesting. You think there's a whole kind of political subplot, and I mean, not to spoil it for folks, but just her basic chemistry with the people that she is paired with. In the third season, the big difference with the third season is that her main partner for the first two is no longer a part of the third. I think the actor playing him didn't want to do it anymore. And their chemistry was such a big part of the first two, you would think, oh, maybe this is going to be worse now. And you kind of miss him, but you don't really miss him at all. Like, it doesn't matter. As long as she's there, the show works. Yeah.
I will check it out.
Yeah.
All right. You guys are listening to Pop Rocket. We will be right back to talk about the election in pop culture after this.
I'm Biz.
And I'm Teresa.
And we host the podcast One Bad Mother, a comedy podcast about parenting.
Parenthood. It turns out it is very difficult, but we all get up every day and do it again.
It's like the sign says, if you're going through hell, keep going.
So join us each week as we strive for less judging and more laughing.
Find us on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts when your children aren't around.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are
Winter Mitchell,
Oliver Wang,
and Karen Tongson.
And we were wanting to talk about the election thus far as it's been represented in popular culture. It's kind of an interesting election because our big character on the Republican side is a figure from popular culture. And our big figure on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton, has been around so long that she is also kind of a figure from popular culture. Like on last week's SNL, we got that fun moment where Kate McKinnon and
Amy Poehler
got to sort of like have their Hillary Clinton's face off and explore the way that this lady has, you know, evolved over the past 8 years.
Or not.
Or not. So let's start with the elephant in the room. Like Donald Trump, how do you feel we're dealing with managing him in popular culture as a political figure?
How are we managing him? I mean, I think that no one is managing. I mean, the thing is that he has just become this unmanageable, like, thing.
Yeah.
Right? And as you know, there are anti-Trump memes that are successful. There are shockingly people who just love the spectacle or the idea of a president. I can't believe I'm saying this, like, but the idea that, you know, of a president who has some, I mean, it's kind of a perverted version, some version of fame, right?
Yeah.
Because it's sort of a much more perverse and horrifying thought even than like Ronald Reagan,
right?
Like the movie actor becoming president.
But now this is a reality
now
star.
It's a reality. Yeah. And now, yeah, we've completely compromised even the standards or genres from which we would call an entertainer who becomes president of the United States.
Well, there's something so interesting about that. The age of Reagan really was these sort of like presentational politicians who were about the message more than any sort of policy. And then as you've watched the debates recently, like Trump coming in willing to say anything has confounded these dudes who really think that they are supposed to be never saying anything dangerous, that they're always supposed to be on script. And I think a lot of people are really excited about having this dude who's off script.
I think on the one hand, we're used to talking about politics as theater. And I think that sounds great until you actually have someone who lives up to that in the way that Trump has. And you realize, oh, maybe I don't actually want my politics to be like theater. Maybe I just want it to be more like politics. And I think that in the beginning, because it just seemed so absurd, the idea that Trump would be a viable candidate, it was entertaining because when he went off script, it was just him being the absurdist candidate we assumed he was, as he's gained or seemingly gained some legitimacy. And I've seen so many different pundits basically keep saying, he's not viable. Don't believe the polls. It's not going to happen. I'm like, all right, Nate Silver, whatever you say, man. But the way in which the media has focused on, it's not just the kind of outrageous, absurdist points, but the things that are like really dangerously fascist and scary, mm-hmm. and the way that which his followers have responded to it. It becomes sort of like Now that we actually have a candidate who understands the theatricalness of politics, it's actually really fucking scary.
Yeah, 100%.
And I really want him to go away soon, which it's not going to happen.
So this week or last week, W. Kamau Bell posted a long article where he said basically, like, Trump as a guy who has racialized politics more than anyone has explicitly
In generations.
Like, it's all been implicit, and this guy has made it sort of, like, out there. Kamau basically said, white people, this is your job. You need to, like, be managing your own household and push for a whites against Trump
hashtag.
And I was just wondering how you guys felt about sort of social media's reaction to him and whether it's been appropriate and whether it's been effective.
To Kamau or to Trump?
To Trump.
I mean, every time Trump tweets something out, I go and I look at what the responses are to him. They're overwhelmingly negative. Like, people are just like, it ranges from everything to people challenging him on policy to saying that he's, you know, just being an idiot again. I think that most people who are reasonable, and maybe they're just liberals, feel like he's most of my liberal friends feel like he's trying to say as much as he can because I don't think he ever thought he'd get this far. Mm-hmm. He's not going to quit, so he'd rather martyr himself than quit because quitting is what losers do, and he's not a loser. He's a winner.
Right.
So there's much more of a notion that he can't be taken seriously, yet the polls grow every week, yet he can still engage in a debate on stage, and you see how the media positions him when there's a debate. Mm-hmm. When they're doing their promos, he's front and center everything. He's in the middle of all of the candidates on stage.
Are we Sanjaya-ing an election?
100%.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the only reason why I'm not having fun with it is because I don't think he's going to win. No. But I think that
the minute he finishes even second in any state, his narrative is broken. You know, like his narrative of I'm a winner, you're a loser,
right,
becomes a lot more difficult. But now it's...
Who's going to win, though?
I mean...
That's the question.
Who's going to win? Ben Carson has literally was like right on his ass and then just, you know, stab that kid like he claimed he did.
the Republican Party is fundamentally conservative. Trump, however conservative he may claim to be, is a very radical choice, a very radical choice. And I feel like business interests will try to figure out some nice, responsible candidate to fall behind. But you are right in that none of them have really provided the standard to get behind.
I think Trump is the electorate's id in the same way that Obama was the electorate's superego.
Okay.
And I mean, you know, I think that there's a way in which when Obama was first elected in office in 2008, there was a way in which some people fantasized that it was a form of reparation, right? And that it would be some kind of one quick solution to the nation's many centuries of fucked up, like, race politics, civil rights issues, et cetera. And now that, you know, because anyone who governs will have a difficult time, whoever occupies the White House, you know, now there's this sense that, well, why don't we break free from politics as usual, which is the same rhetoric every election cycle, but really go for it this time. Like, you know, think about these really kind of extreme solutions or non-solutions or ways in which those especially angry white men who felt incredibly frustrated by the kind of super egoic function of the Obama presidency want to unleash all of that dirty, dark shit. And Trump becomes the avatar or the figure for that.
Having one person there who's not saying in any way you need to feel responsible for, like, anything that's bad is liberating to a lot of people because there has been a political consensus of, like, crazy things like racism is bad or, you know, we need to look honestly at the problem of immigration and illegal immigrants and the role that they play in our economy. And Trump has no tie to responsible policy. He just has a tie to telling you what you want to hear.
Right. But there's something when Ronald Reagan did this, I was too young to have a voice in it. I was dealt with what the cards how they were laid out. I was born in 1980, and he was elected that year, correct?
Yeah.
Or 81.
80.
So then it's 2016 almost. I've voted three times at this point, four times maybe. I'm voting again, and now my vote, it's important, it factors, but it's the people, the generation behind me that are trying to make decisions for the next 20 years. Whoever we have elect into office is going to dictate the next 20 years of this country and how everything's going to, you know, sort of wash out. That affects me for retirement. That affects me for my any kids that I decide to have or traumatize. So, like, my whole thing is that I would have expected – I was fine with Ronald Reagan because he was a figurehead when I was a kid. It was a figurehead. He loved jelly beans. He was an actor. He hung out with the monkey. That was like cute then because I didn't have any ties to it. But now that I'm a full-fledged adult, you know, heading into 40, like I can't look at this election and take it seriously. Like it scares me that it's being such a caricature of what politics should be, especially after we've had a president. And look, I'm a liberal who I don't agree with everything that Obama's done, but I do agree that he has basically represented himself very well. He's positioned the family very well, and he's been responsible in how he deals with the public and how he deals with even being a pop culture figure.
All right, I'm going to make two points.
Mm-hmm.
The first is that a lot of the tools that we have traditionally used to sort of like keep politicians in line was sort of like sapping their dignity through parody, through Doonesbury and SNL and stuff like that, making fun of them. And if they went too cartoonish, making them a cartoon in a way that hurt them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to say that both Obama and Trump have contributed to a breakdown in that system.
Yes.
In that 8 years of Obama, he has so parsed every word that he never veered into the cartoonish because we wouldn't let the black guy be cartoonish.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so during those 8 years, the available satire wasn't that. So something much grosser had to happen in racist caricatures. Mm-hmm. He's not really an American. Mm-hmm. Those were the things that were used to attack him. And then Trump comes along, and he's not scared of being a cartoon.
Right.
His power is being a cartoon.
Yeah. I was going to say along those lines, when people complain about all the attention that Trump is getting, and I do think that his prominence relative to what might end up being his real political clout, I hope we're going to discover it was way inflated, and partially because he's gotten all of this attention.
Mm-hmm.
But people who complain about it, I feel like you're not really complaining about Trump. You don't really understand how media works, which is if there's someone out there that people are fascinated by. I mean, the thing is, we went through this with Palin 8 years ago. Did we not remember any lessons from that? I mean, this is sort of how newspapers and television stations work.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the ease and simplicity of hot take journalism, like the fun of writing a "Can you believe they said that?"
Right.
is so extreme now that that's all we know how to pay attention to, and we can't talk about any of the real
like substantive policy because that's boring. And who wants to read? Yeah, how are you gonna hot take that?
But I feel like both Trump and Bernie Sanders are reflective of the way that social media has broken through a lot of these institutions. The thing about Palin is Palin was brought to us by institutions on the old Ronald Reagan platter.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Obama was a magical situation where a bunch of people were able to contribute $5 and $10 and take down, like, some really big political behemoths. And now we've got this weird election where Bernie is posing a kind of real challenge to Hillary Clinton off of, like, small actors organizing. And Trump really is reflective of something completely outside of the Republican,
machine
taking power there.
Bernie Sanders, he's basically following the Barack Obama book to how to be a social media rock star for a campaign. And to that, I have to give him tremendous credit for it because he is sticking to it and his formula is working. It's just a page out of that book and sort of taking it a step further and adding footnotes.
Can you just break that down real quick? Like, what is that include?
So, you know, not to be a company girl, but the fact that he has a subreddit on Reddit has been incredibly useful. I mean, they're on the front page regularly, and that's a strong media and that's a strong form to sort of galvanize your base and have open discussions there. But it's also when something happens in real time, he responds in real time. And he doesn't respond just with, like, superlatives and colorful bullshit. bullshit like Trump. He comes out and he takes a position, just like with Sandra Bland, saying she wouldn't have died if she were a white woman. That's a very controversial statement. That's something that, whether he's placating to us or not, it's definitely taking a position that most other people are not willing to sort of take.
But look at the way that he managed the leak. For those of you who don't know, the DNC had worked with independent contractors about something, and they ended up giving information from the Clinton campaign to the Sanders campaign, and some people on his staff were using it and not sort of like giving it back
being
and being transparent. And he responded with immediate terminations, immediate transparency, and saying, like, this is not the kind of campaign I want to run, because he understands that's all he has. All he has is the notion that he's not part of the machine in the same way. And on the subject of media representations of people, I encourage anyone to go look at Funny or Die videos of James Adomian doing Bernie Sanders, because like SNL's like having Larry David do Bernie Sanders really is just leaning into the old Jew of it all. And I believe I was the first person to say that Bernie Sanders always sounds like he is sending back soup. but James Adomian does a magnificent Bernie Sanders that really captures a lot of nuances, like his obsession with detail and his complete lack of fear to wade into detail.
Can I just say something really fast, follow up on my last point about Bernie, is that Bernie, the one thing that I really do love about him, and I'm still so undecided, but the biggest I love that he is who he is. He is a product of everything that he's worked for, and he really stands in his truth. The one thing that makes me nervous is we've had 8 years of a young, handsome, virile president, to the point where I've endeared Obama like he's a family member. And it was refreshing to have someone that wasn't like, the wife is just on the outskirts of menopause and the girls are still developing and learning about the ways of the world. They were a family, a young family. Right. So now I feel bad because I actually really want Bernie to make it to the finish line. And my concern is that he's fighting against the establishment. But then it's also that he's an older gentleman. Mm-hmm. And that's now something that I feel bad about, because we were so when Obama was coming out, it was always about this young, hot, hip president. And now we're sort of heading into this phase where I want Bernie to win, but he's older than I would want him.
Or Hillary, who's in her late 60s. So either way, no matter who gets the nom, it's going to be.
The thing is that women who achieve positions of sort of like the height of power in a country, it usually is when they are postmenopausal. It is sort of, you know, the grandma, the matriarch, a nice Golda Meir. And there's something.
Golda.
There's something so. Look, Karen, if anything on this planet, like, nothing makes me sadder than the fact that America's first female president won't be someone who was not part of somebody else's political dynasty. Yeah. But it is an uphill battle, and the fact that she is bringing to the table so much, like, she and Trump, we just know so much about them. Yeah. Donald Trump has been on television since Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous the 80s. Like, we've watched Ivanka grow up. These are already existing cultural figures who can then be deployed. You don't have to get a celebrity to endorse you. The celebrities who are endorsing you are on, like, in your family or Omarosa. Like, Hillary is sort of bringing a similar kind of thing. And for her, I feel like the strength of being such a media figure is just that we've already fired all of our bullets at her. Well, she's the 50 Cent of politics.
And she's still standing. Well, I mean, she has to fight against, you know, in the Star Wars world, General Leia's, like, you know, the way in which she's been received, or even Carrie Fisher, the actress, has been received, like, performing that role. Hillary Clinton has that same kind of baggage around, like, people and the kind of spectacle of aging femininity.
Yeah.
But the one thing I wanted to say about, like, the Democratic field and its relationship to pop culture is, as Winter was saying, you know, Bernie Sanders' team is definitely much more finger on the pulse with kind of millennial platforms. But, you know, it seems to me that Hillary Clinton's primary strategy now is to make as many correlations between herself and Tea Leoni as Madam Secretary. And that's exactly the demo that she's going to succeed with. Because, you know, in fact, in the I think may have been in the first or the second Dem debate, she referred to a scene that happened in real life where she and Obama at a kind of climate conference or summit stalked, you know, another world leader to get him to like sign off on something else or like on a clean climate bill. And you know, and I was like, wow, that's exactly what happened on Madam Secretary last week. Alex McCord, Tea Leoni, and President Dalton, you know, in a low point where, you know, went and barged in. I'm sure it was based on actual events, on the stuff that Hillary actually did. But I think that that is the one shot she has at making some sort of resonant and maybe slightly newer, if still a bit in an older demo, kind of like resonant gesture.
Well, you know the Borgen story of they made the Danish TV show about first female prime minister, and then they elected the lady leader of that moderate party to be their prime minister.
Yeah.
And there's something really interesting about the arc of in the middle of the 90s, we started making movies where we fictionalized Bill Clinton. We made Bullworth. We made the American president. And we tried to ask the question, what if
political animals?
What?
Primary colors.
Primary
colors was like very much on point. But I feel like the fictionalizations were really hitting. What if we had a president who could just date? but also, what if he were a real liberal?
Mm-hmm.
And then somewhere around 2000, you started getting the shift to fictionalizations of Hillary, that you had political animals, that you had Madam Secretary, you had the commander-in-chief. The good wife. The good wife, yes.
To a certain extent, yeah.
And so that these are stories that are both like embracing the troubled relationship between a political wife and her husband, but then also sort of what does it feel like when we are placing the reins in the hands of, you know, an older stately woman.
Mm-hmm. But what is so wrong? That's what I still can't understand. And maybe because I've just was born a feminist woman. But what is so wrong? It's like when I'm on Virgin America and Virgin America has changed their TSA, FAA, you know, don't if we go down, here's how it's going to happen videos. They've made them into like a YouTube video.
Yeah.
And I find that so insulting because it's like, I'm not an idiot. If the plane's going down, I don't want the last vision of anything to be you guys dancing around with gas masks on your face.
Fly.
Yeah, that's so insulting to me. And there's some things that maybe just because I'm a part of the lost generation that I just really hold to. And that's like, I don't want my president to be a fucking goofball. I don't want my president to have a reality show on NBC and to be like the creator of Miss Universe pageants. I want somebody who has a policy, and I don't care if she's kind of stodgy, cold, frigid, and like needs yams to get moist. Like, I don't care about those things. I want her to have a policy.
She's referencing Sex and the City too.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I never saw.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Samantha's postmenopausal diet. Yeah.
Mexican yams have a solid source of estrogen.
Okay.
They are a good bioidentical plant estrogen.
You really don't need to explain this, but thank you.
I'm right on top of it.
Yes.
Figuring out some degree of permeability and relatability for public figures, I feel like it's maybe kind of an arc we're going to go through where at this point in time we sort of like demand it because our figures were for such a long time so stodgy and distant, and then we'll get over it and we'll let them do that job and have other people do the relatability job. I always go back to Princess Diana cracking under the pressure of people needing her to relate to them and be in their lives, and the way that Kate Middleton in a post-survivor world just understands how to give us enough and not give us too much. And like, we all know Hillary Clinton is just pretending to be relatable. And at this point in time, her gestures are adorable.
Yes.
Yeah.
May the force be with you. She signed off the debate with that. And then she was like, that's pretty much all I'm going to give you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I understand why, because everybody was yelling at her, you're too cold and clinical. And like, she went to college before women could go to most Ivy League schools. She has been fighting against being that overconfident girl for her entire life, and I can't begrudge her struggle.
Me neither.
Yeah.
I can't either.
Yeah.
I would also say that, you know, election after election, if you actually look based analyzing the data afterwards, what most people vote for are presidents who they feel like can handle things like the economy. And
right.
it, all this kind of relatability and personality shit, I mean, that plays well in the media. It plays well in our discussions of it. But in the end, is that what people are actually voting for?
No.
That's a really open question. But we go through this cycle every 4 years.
But the thing of would you have a beer with them, I think, does go into our like most subtle and like fundamental concepts of what authority and likability are.
Right,
and those
right.
are very much rooted in like a world where white guys are in charge. And figuring out how to break white guys being in charge requires some degree of playing those dynamics differently. Or in Hillary's case, just twice as harding to get half as far
right.
for
yeah.
the past 50 years. All right, you're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back after this.
Hello, and welcome to Podphone. What type of podcast are you looking for?
You have chosen funny podcasts about bad movies.
Rated R. May we recommend The Flophouse.
Three friends talk about bad movies and make each other and you laugh.
Rated R. The Flophouse is playing at your ears.
If you download it right now or whenever.
Rated R. To purchase tickets to The Flophouse, you don't need to do that. Just download it. The Flophouse, rated R for nudity, I guess.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are
Winter Mitchell,
Karen Tongson,
Oliver Wang.
Every week on Pop Rocket, we asked our panel, what's your current jam? So I'm going to ask you, Oliver, what's your current jam?
This would have been more appropriate for our holiday song show, but I only just learned about it. And since this episode probably will air right before Christmas, I am going to go with one more holiday song for the year. And this is not Sleigh Ride. It's called Sleigh Rough, and it's done by Chris Long. I found it on YouTube. It's Jingle Bells, not quite like you've heard it before. And we have to listen to at least a minute of it because it starts off normal and then things go a little bit off the rails. I can't fully articulate why I take so much comedic enjoyment from it because
it's halfway in between jazz and it's a like, sixth grade band.
Yeah.
It's terrible, but it's like entertainingly terrible. And I figure that the people who put the Chris Long and his friends who put this out, they probably are very well trained musicians because
yeah.
in order to make it that bad, there has to be precision execution in doing it. But the more when I first started listening to them, it's like, this can't be that funny. And the more I just sat with it, I'm like, oh my God, this is hilarious. For reasons that I can't quite articulate, but its terribleness is exactly what makes it so endearing. That's Sleigh Rough by Chris Long.
Winner, what's your jam?
My jam is FIFA, FIFA by Pusha T.
Yes.
His album just came out last week. It's a pretty good listen. This is a pretty good song.
You've been trying to tie me to the balcony. Too many clicks in the dial tone. How my city's Willie Falcone. How you niggas celebrating Alpo? I'm disgusted. Interior rustic. The mustard colored walls adjusted. Trap doors everywhere. Max come out the floors. Dinner's at the forge.
And he makes a Chris Hansen reference, which is funny. Love Chris Hansen.
Do you know who produced that?
This?
Yeah.
Oh, God, no.
Okay.
I just listened.
Karen, what's your jam?
I was going to go with the number one song in the land, Justin Bieber's Sorry, because I just had a really radiant experience of watching the music video with a bunch of awesome queer women like on a big giant couch and with a big screen. Anyway, but I just opted for something more wholesome and holiday oriented. And let's just start the song.
Greeting cards have all been sent. The Christmas rushes through. But I still have one wish to make, a special one for you.
darling. So I don't know how many of you know that I am named after Karen Carpenter.
Really?
And so this
Breaking news. She
is my namesake. And I think that there is no other holiday or Christmas song.
That your
that
parents
is
a music act is something we always need to remember.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and my mom and my bio dad met in a production of Jesus Christ Superstar, actually. In any case, and that's when they decided they would name me after Karen Carpenter. But... You know, so this song to me, and there's a piece that I recently read about this that will be coming out in The Believer soon. This Christmas song to me, there's no Christmas song that reminds me more of the Philippines than Merry Christmas, Darling. And precisely because the Carpenters have a kind of extended afterlife and a certain kind of popularity there that I explored. Like, not only throughout my entire life of being overly identified with this, you know, the Karen, but also just through the sense of how her voice, that voice, you know, became this kind of, for me, this relationship with what America might mean and what whiteness might be, that was it very much at the same time, like really super deeply embedded in my own like familial and cultural experience. And so if we can come back up to minute 240, this part right here. And I love that the Carpenters were such a hermetic act that what they did was overdub each other's voices into this kind of what I call an infinite redoubling of sameness. And I think that there's something about this song that at once provides a sense of joy from those tones, but also, as you're saying, a kind of loneliness and melancholy. And so there you go. That is my jam for the season.
As a 70s baby, and my parents both like the Carpenters, we were making a joke about, you know, Madeline and Proust a moment ago. But for me, I think on a musical Madeline level, it really is Karen Carpenter's voice. And it this always – every time I hear that particular timbre, it just takes me back to growing up outside of Boston. And I know that she's a – I mean, her and her brother from Long Beach, the school has a – you know, or where I teach has a performing arts center named after them. But for me, it reminds me of like 70s in New England just because of having grown up listening to that voice.
But it's so funny that it reminds you of that, and it immediately reminds me of growing up in the 80s sitting in the TV room while my grandmother prepares Christmas dinner. Mm-hmm. So it's also like 80s San Francisco just listening to it, but I'm saying it's like they have that voice so seminal and timeless and distinctive, and everybody has a Karen Carpenter emotion about the day that she passed.
There are a lot, like, the cold and distant whiteness, like, of what they are throwing down with is so appealing to so many gay guys who really like
the kind of steely withholding maternal figure.
Yes. Wasp dystopia.
Brittle. Yeah. I am not one of they. Like, I'm not one of them. I love and appreciate Karen Carpenter and the Carpenters, but I do always, to me, they live in a Southern California that exists on television and is to some extent unrelatable. And I will always like a Shonen Knife top of the world.
You will just have to read my piece, shameless plug, Whiteness and Promises on Echoes of Karen Carpenter. And it's about all these
totally
different
reading
things.
That.
I would love to. All right. Mine is stupid, so I'll go before you, Oliver. The other day at work, a girl was talking about how good and deep and complex Fleetwood Mac songs were. And one of the other writers, Charlie Grandy, being an asshole, said, like Holiday Road. And I remembered it was a great song. And it's a terrible song, but it's a great song. And let's listen to it.
This song.
What movie uses
National Lampoon's Vacation?
There is something about a musical artist who has proved himself, who's in like his 40s, who's like doing a like high budget tie-in for a movie, but also don't give a fuck. Like there's this song reminds me a little bit of George Harrison's I've Got My Mind Set on You, the sort of like weird giganticness of these dudes from the 60s and 70s just like having fun in the 80s.
Billy Joel's It's Still Rock and Roll to Me.
Exactly, exactly. And to all of them, no, I would like to say thank you, Cocaine. your work is still with us today. Oliver.
I went first.
Oh, you
did? I did Jingle Rough, yeah. we can re-edit it to cut it like that, but just to let you know. It's all good.
All right.
Those Christmas parties are getting to you, Branham.
Yeah.
You've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branham, with Major Mitchell, Oliver Wang, and Karen Thompson. Thank you so much for sharing yourself with us.
Always
today.
A pleasure.
Do you have anything you want to plug?
I kept talking about the Believer essay, so just look out for this special double issue on music that's coming out in the new year.
Check it out at all of your favorite academic bookstores.
It's a regular magazine. Yeah.
We'll post show notes every week at MaximumFun.org. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to Leonetti, Michael, Three Dimes Down, Nora Next, and Veg Jeff for the 5-star reviews in iTunes. If you haven't already, please go and review us. Get in touch with us on Twitter at Pop Rocket. Join our Facebook group. This week, tell us what's your favorite on or off Broadway musical adaptation to film. Oliver.
Can we preview what the first show of the new year is going to be?
Oh, yes.
You guys, our first show of the new year is going to be the first annual Pop Rocket Awards of Merit, woo-hoo, the Pop Tarts.
Yes.
We are going to decide what arts and entertainment were the best from calendar year 2015. So get ready for it. It's going to be splashtacular. We are a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producer is the thoroughly Republican in the anti-monarchical sense, Colin Anderson.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.